I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, it's another installment of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. We begin with a conversation about a new film that chronicles the history of African Americans in horror movies. Over the course of the last 100 years, from caricature and exploitation to an embrace of black culture, how have horror movies shaped the conversation around race in America? Tananarive Due joins us. She's the producer of Horror Noir. Then, God is Ratings Gold on TV. From Highway to Heaven in the 1980s to the new CBS hit God Friended Me, representations of the Judeo-Christian God have often been successful. A conversation about the enduring popularity of faith-based narratives on television. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, it's another edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's a scholar of popular culture and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She's also the host of Beyond the Ballot here on WYPR, which airs twice a month on Thursday afternoons during All Things Considered. And she joins us on the first Tuesday of the month to talk about all things cultural. You're busy, Sherry.
Hi there.
I'm exhausted just thinking about what you do. It's good to have you back.
Oh, thank
Welcome.
You.
And we're going to take up two different cultural phenomena today. A little later in the show, we're going to talk about representations of God on television and why it is that even as society becomes more secular, the Almighty continues to command heavenly ratings. But first, a look at the history of African Americans in horror movies. On Thursday, Shudder TV will premiere a terrific new documentary called Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. The film offers a fresh, fearless, and affectionately humorous ethnographic examination into representations and contributions of African Americans in this popular genre. From the virulent racist Birth of a Nation to the triumph of Jordan Peele's Get Out, Horror Noir explores more than 100 years of African Americans in scary movies, the creative brilliance of the black artists within the genre, and how they endeavored to become the center of their own stories. Joining us from the studios of NPR in New York, Tananarive Due. She's one of the film's executive producers. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
And I got to tell you, I just thought this was a terrific movie. I saw it last night and I just really enjoyed it an awful lot. And Sherry, I know you feel the same way.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that. When you're close to a project, it's hard to tell how audiences will react.
Yep.
But after a couple premieres, one in Hollywood and one in Brooklyn last night, it's like, yes, they like it.
Yeah, we
like your child too.
Yeah, right.
So I get to ask the first question, and you know, one of the things that we've talked about on the show is that popular culture provides the space to examine ideas that cannot be safely played out elsewhere. And you know, your documentary points out that horror is perfect for that. Can you talk about that? I mean, because that's clearly one of the ideas that you run throughout the film about horror playing a specific role.
Absolutely. I'm a lifelong fan of the genre, you know, I should say. And the first horror fan of my life was my mother, which is true of a lot of black horror fans I've met. Maybe it's just true of horror fans in general. And I've really come to realize that she used it as a way to ease racial trauma. It wasn't sort of the fun roller coaster ride. It was for me as a kid, like, oh, wee, that's scary. It was, you know, she came of age under Jim Crow. She never attended an integrated school. In her entire school career, she was injured by a police officer during a peaceful protest in 1960 from tear gas and wore dark glasses for the rest of her life. So there's a kind of a fearfulness. You know, growing up, our parents didn't tell us, but in newly integrated neighborhoods, people were making threats against us. There were white friends who were actually sitting sentry outside of the house to try to keep watch over us. People would call you the N-word on the street. So there's this subtle or sometimes not so subtle idea that you're in peril, that strangers might want to harm you, that a population that outnumbers you, sometimes vastly, depending on where you live, might do harm to you, you know, as over history you see whole towns get burned down, you know what I mean? And there's ancestral memory. So how do you process that trauma? Some people lock it down and hang on to it as anger. People process in different ways, but horror in particular gives us an opportunity to imagine something scary that's visual. And sometimes it's the thing itself, like Jordan Peele's Get Out, where racism really is the monster, and that's the thing we're talking about. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's a demon. Sometimes it's a monster or a zombie as a metaphor for the real life horror. But it really, I think my mother found, and I am finding more and more as I ask myself, well, why do I like horror so much? Why do I write so much horror? It's this idea that you can hold it at a safe distance, see it in all of its frightening characteristics, and then expel it. And it lets some of that tension out.
Getting rid of it. People may think that you're talking about the most horrific moments in the film, and you certainly are. But one of the things that I noticed, and there was a person you interviewed that says, if you're African-American, you're always on the lookout for something that will mess with you. And in horror films, there's always this tension, no matter what's going on, because you know something's going to happen. And that day-to-day chronic trauma of always being on the lookout is something that you pull out and think about in the film.
Yes, you know, from the opening scene in Get Out, where the character Andre, played by Lakeith Stanfield, is walking through the white suburban neighborhood. You know, there are so many of us who have been in that situation. I was actually shooting a short film on a hiking trail once and got lost. And I ended up off of the trail in the middle of a neighborhood I had never visited before, looking grubby, holding a bunch of stuff. I looked... And I was like, oh, my God, let me get out of here before someone calls the cops on me. And I can laugh about it. But, you know, as the mother of a teenage son, my son just turned 15, and he's always been tall for his age. There's that dread that you have as a parent that your child, your sweet, innocent child, does not look like a sweet, innocent child to an outsider or to a police officer. He looks like a monster. He looks like a threat, like a thug. So it's a very real and visceral fear that a lot of us live with every day.
And, you know, as it happens, today would have been Trayvon Martin's 24th birthday.
Yeah, that one was hard.
And somebody in the movie, and forgive me if it was you, says that Black history is Black horror. Mm. And so there's this, you know, there's this connection. And then you make the observation, which I thought is really trenchant, that monsters and aliens are often stand-ins for African Americans, even if you're not present in the story. And Get Out was a very, you know, a different paradigm there. But for many, many films prior to that, the representations of African Americans, whether they were done metaphorically or literally, are really problematic. This is a long history, too. It's interesting to think. I mean, Birth of a Nation is like 100 years ago.
Yeah, and this is where I have to give a shout-out to Dr. Robin R. Means Coleman, who wrote the book that this film was adapted from. She published it in 2011, and it was a very comprehensive history. And it was eye-opening to me, you know, as a horror writer and fan of the genre. I mean, yes, of course, you can look at Birth of a Nation and see the monstrous depiction of Gus in blackface and how it reverberates through history, this whole idea that the Klan is this romanticized, you know, group of protectors of white virtue, and that black men are the monsters. I mean, look at how that still plays out today in terms of the furor over taking down Confederate statues that, by the way, were being erected during the same era, you know, during the 1915 and the 1920s. So it's still a part of our political conversation. It's where the birth of Hollywood began. It was the first blockbuster. And I have to really give Dr. Coleman credit, because as a kid watching King Kong, Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Mole People, I think of all those films, maybe I could sense as a kid that The Mole People represented the disenfranchised. Maybe, you know, but I didn't see it in Creature from the Black Lagoon. I didn't see it in King Kong until I read her book. And then was like, oh, so we were present even when we weren't present. And this is just sort of a disguised version of Gus, you know, from Birth of a Nation when you watch a film like King Kong.
And film does that.
Yeah. And of course, this week we've had this bizarre situation with Governor Ralph Northam in Virginia, a picture of a person in blackface and another person in a Klansman outfit happens to show up mysteriously on his yearbook page from medical school, of all things, in the 1980s. And this, for some reason, occasioned some soul searching of none other than an actor named Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson, who was talking about thoughts that he had and ruminations that he that were engendered when a friend of his had been raped. Here's a little bit about of what he told a reporter a few days ago.
I asked, "Did she know who it was?" "No." "What color were they?" "She said it was a black person." I went up and down areas with a cosh, hoping I'd be approached by somebody. I'm ashamed to say that. And I did it for maybe a week, hoping some black would come out of a pub and have a go at me about something, you know, so that I could kill him. And it was horrible, horrible when I think back. But I did that, and I've never admitted that.
And you make the point in the film that in the 80s, in the Reagan era, black people in general were set up as representational of everything that was wrong with America, the welfare queens and that whole trope. And clearly, these are thoughts that are running through the heads of an awful lot of white people to this day.
Wow, my eyes are bugging out over that clip you just played. I had not heard that. I want to learn more about the whole context of that admission and that confession that he's making. But yes, for so many Americans, even in his book, Dreams from My Father, Barack Obama talks about the fear of black men that he noticed, in his own grandmother in an elevator. And this is, it's like a common thing. It's almost a joke among so many people that if you, and I find it too, I have short hair, I'm a woman. But if I'm walking in a suburban neighborhood at night, I know I look like a man from a distance. And, I've seen people cross the street. It's so I laugh about it. But it's really not funny because sometimes it does end up in a situation like with the Trayvon Martin, where a vigilante sort of gets to decide randomly who lives or dies and literally hunt someone and still not face justice over it because... deep down, jurors, police officers, casual observers are like, well, I would have been scared too. I would have thought the same thing. That could have been me. They're not empathizing with a child, literally. Trayvon is a child. They're not empathizing with a child. They're empathizing with the fear because it is so universal, so deeply wound into our national DNA. And, a lot of the more overt conversation these days is about immigrants, about brown people, that dehumanization. Like if a mother asks for medical attention and an ICE agent will say, well, you're an invader. That word invader means you are not human. You are a threat. You are not worthy of medical care for your child. And it's both tragic and fascinating how quickly and consistently people can be dehumanized based on those fears of the other.
Tanarive Du is an executive producer of the documentary film Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about the history of African Americans in horror, the horror genre, both as progenitors and creators of it, as well as actors and people who are represented in the genre. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. If you want to join our conversation, you can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. We're also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page.
Now, one of the reasons we wanted to talk about the Neeson quote is that it gives us a window into that mentality. So it wasn't that he was trying to avenge that alleged black man. He was just taking a word. He was looking for any black man to kill. And I thought that was really interesting because since black men are seen as a group rather than individuals, that any black man would do. And that gives us the insight that you're saying horror gives us in that any person will stand in for the other to avenge this fantasy. He was mostly concerned with his friend, but rather than attend to her, he went out to kill a black man. And it only works if you have to confound the black man who allegedly raped her with any other black man so that that generalization allows horror to work.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you look at mass incarceration, which is a daily and living horror, in which Jordan Peele actually told my class at UCLA was what inspired his notion of the sunken place, was black men being thrown away and cast into holes for, you know, bogus, often bogus or nonviolent offenses. And how our society accepts that is sort of this notion that, well, if it wasn't you doing it, this, you did something, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you hadn't done it, you would have done it if you had a chance. Or, you know, and from the time kids are 12, 13, 14 years old, they are slotted in this school-to-prison pipeline as future predators, current predators, a scourge to be wiped off of the streets, and society doesn't bat an eye in some cases because of just skin color. It's sickening.
And that creates the randomness that is the horror, is that you could be the next black man that Liam Neeson sees and you get killed. So the generalization creates the random threat that is the day-to-day horror of being particularly a black man, but black people.
It's so extraordinary that he would say that. I really do, when we finish, I want to research all the context around this whole conversation. I want to say, well, is that a courageous thing to do, or is that, I don't know, what's going on?
Exactly.
but yeah, I mean, it's, I guess it's honest at least, and in the sense that there are many other people who feel that way who would never utter those words aloud.
I mean, he said he had never admitted it before, and he's ashamed of it, and you know, feels terrible about it. But he realized that that's what he was thinking at that time. In the movie, in your movie, the documentary, you talk about, for example, the movie Night of the Living Dead, and its sort of inextricable connection to the social moment. This movie came out in 1968. Dwayne Jones stars in this movie. He's a black protagonist, which is quite unusual. And here he is killing white zombies, you know, throughout the whole movie. And it was revolutionary because of the socio-political turmoil that America was going through in that very tumultuous year.
Yeah, Night of the Living Dead is a really great example of how art, cinema can rise to a social moment. I mean, the course of the story is that George A. Romero cast Dwayne Jones by accident. He was just the best one at the audition. And that does happen. I would say, though, that it points to progressive thinking that you would even make that casting choice in 1967, whether or not it was conscious that it would speak so directly to the social turmoil of the time. It's the Vietnam era. It's that transitional period between the civil rights era and the sit-ins, and then, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and then moving into the Black Power era, where there's frustration with the civil rights era because it wasn't enough to take down the white-only signs. You know, there was so much work to be done. It was the time of assassinations, even though Dr. King had not yet been assassinated. He was assassinated the year the film came out. So, wow, how much more perfectly could a film address the anxieties of both white and black viewers? You know, the zombies represent society literally falling apart. Those black and white news broadcasts that people were watching about the war and about the civil rights era looks like the film. You know, the film looks like a newsreel in so many ways, speaking directly to that moment of great fright and using that gore horror, which Romero also innovated. You know, he changed what zombies were in film from mindless, shambling kind of slaves to cannibalistic attackers, which is a very different representation of zombies. And you talk about Dwayne Jones. He wasn't just killing white zombies. He also rises up against a white character, Mr. Cooper, who represents sort of a white establishment kind of guy who wants to be in charge. And Dwayne Jones tells him, you're not in charge. You be in charge in the basement. I'm in charge up here, you know, hits him. I mean, all kinds. So this is a very direct confrontation with white male authority. And he's also, you know, in basically caretaking a blonde, shocky, you know, white woman. So that whole rape thing and fears of black male lust for white women, there's a lot going on in that lens when George Romero was shooting that film.
And there's a twist at the end, though, because he is, up until the end, the heroic character. And yet, I mean, one of the most horrific scenes is then he gets shot.
He's killed, yeah.
And burned at the pyre. I mean, it was...
Yeah, what a shock. He gets shot by the white mob.
Right.
That he's been protecting.
That he's been protecting the whole movie. Right.
It was devastating.
I was very taken that throughout the film, you show how often the horror film is tracking what's going on to Black America, with lynchings and the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. I mean, that's an extraordinary path that you point out.
Yeah, you know, some of these decisions by filmmakers are driven by headlines. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's sort of a collective consciousness and genetic memory, you know, where these images, but you're absolutely right. You know, during the syphilis, when all that blew up and it became public that these men basically had been sentenced to death from syphilis because they were not treated even after the penicillin cure was discovered. Never mind that they didn't even know what kind of study some of them that they were taking part in. So yeah, that's going to show up even in a kind of a schlocky blaxploitation Black horror film, this idea of experimentation on Black bodies. And you see it echoed again now in Jordan Peele's Get Out, that experimentation of theft of Black bodies.
You also have wonderful things to say about the role of Black women in these films. Voodoo and the association between Black women and voodoo is a theme that you explore a little bit. You talk about what one of the commentators refers to as the magical Negro, who's able to come in and transform things. There's the Pam Grier type characters. I mean, it really runs the gamut. And Chris Sherry's done a lot of work on strong Black women as well. But that was a thing that I found really fascinating as well.
Yeah, and very early cinema, you know, the Black voodoo queen starts to show up, sort of this mysterious Black magic that whites should be afraid of, you know, this hidden power that Blacks and especially Black women could wield over people. And that is something that comes up. And, you know, even Black creators have used that because it is a part of the culture of a lot of families, especially if you're from Louisiana or from the South. There are these old stories from your grandmother. But when it makes its way to the film, I remember I wrote a book called The Good House that has some voodoo themes. And I was developing it many, many years ago with Forrest Whitaker, and he wanted to take the voodoo aspect out because it had been so ill treated by Hollywood that even in the hands of Black creators, he was like, you know, it's hard to do that right. And certainly cinema has done it wrong for many, many years. But over time, so it's been the voodoo, it's been sort of then sex demons, as you start to see in Blaxploitation films like Abby, with a fear of Black women's sexuality. But what's starting to happen now is that you do see more Black women in horror films coming to the forefront as very strong characters. The Girl with All the Gifts is a good example, a very young actress who basically is the future of the planet. She represents a new kind of human being, superior to us in many ways, right, as regular humans. And she has a Black face. So there's still work to be done. We don't have enough Black women directors, period, much less Black women directors in horror, which I think would be very important. One exception is Casey Lemons, who used voodoo, I think, very gently in her film, because her film Eve's Bayou is much more about human horror than it is about supernatural horror. But voodoo and magic are a mechanism by which you create a loss of innocence story for a young child who believes that she might have killed her father through voodoo, when in fact her father, played by Samuel L. Jackson, pretty much killed himself by his behavior.
And Tom said early on that this was humorous, so people might be confused by that. You take on, you know, what Black audiences have been saying for a long time, you know, the Black person dies first. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because the audience may not all know what you mean about the Black person dying.
There are these tropes, and I teach a course at UCLA on black horror called The Sunken Place, and one of the things I teach is these very basic tropes that you see again and again in horror films. So there's the first to die, which we'll talk about, the magical Negro, which you brought up, the sacrificial Negro, which sometimes you can combine, really you can be all three, you could be a magical first to die sacrificial Negro. And it's a role that is, you know, I really can't put my finger on why there's this fascination with blacks of sort of mystic people. Some of it is that history in cinema. Some of it is just that I guess people don't know us in life and have to put us in these categories. Like Morgan Freeman used to always play God to speak to your next segment.
It's older than that. It's way older than that.
Yeah.
But it's way older than that. Yeah. But in any case, so the first to die one is a fairly simple thing. It's either a malicious thing where, and I, you know, I can't think of a film where I can say with certainty it was done maliciously, but I'm sure it has been, where someone has some attitudes and a black character death is visually satisfying, you know? But I think more often it's a blind spot where you're trying to be inclusive or your studio has said, we need a rapper in this or we need a black face in this for demographic reasons. And they're not going to be a major character. They're going to be kind of a, you know, a character that they've seen that's familiar from films they've seen before. So we're repeating tropes over and over again.
Yeah,
but most
you put them in the movie and then you kill them off early. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
but yeah. But more importantly, they're a minor character. So any minor character is, of course, going to be fodder for whatever the threat is, because you have to know the threat is real.
To know that you do. I'm sorry. Do you have a second to stick around a little bit after a break and talk a little bit more about this?
Sure.
That's
sure.
Terrific. We will come back very shortly with Tananarive Due. She's an educator and award-winning author of 12 novels and an executive producer of a terrific film called Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. It's the Midday Culture Connections with Sherry Parks. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, after a week's delay due to the historic 35-day government shutdown, President Trump will give his second State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress tonight. Former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams will deliver the Democratic response. She will make history as the first black woman to deliver the opposition party response. Norman Ornstein, a political scientist and the co-author of the New York Times bestseller One Nation After Trump, will join me with reaction to the president's speech and to Ms. Abrams' response tomorrow here on Midday. Plus, Baltimore journalist Sean Yost and Baltimore Ceasefire co-founder Erica Bridgeford join me to discuss the first ceasefire events of 2019, which took place just this last weekend. And Rory Cahill, our resident expert on all things automotive, will stop by with a look at some of the cars that will be featured at the Motor Trend International Car Show, which comes to Baltimore this weekend. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Our guest is Tananarive Due, who is an educator and an award-winning author of 12 novels. She's one of the executive producers of the documentary film Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. It's going to premiere Thursday on Shudder TV. By the way, you can subscribe to Shudder TV through Amazon and Netflix. So Tananarive Due, talk a little bit about the blaxploitation period. It's interesting how your movie talks about how sometimes black people are invisible in horror films, as you mentioned right before we went to the break, often playing these minor characters. Other times they are very much front and center. And this blaxploitation era, which was roughly the 1970s or so, is a really interesting historical period.
You know, it is, and it's a hybrid period in the sense that there are things to celebrate and there are things to wince at, you know, through the period. Not all the films are created equal. On the negative side, it's pretty quick to see what would be wrong. There's misogyny and, you know, the pimp and hoe culture is being sort of celebrated and elevated and caricatured in some ways. It had a lasting and unfortunate impact. Even a film like Blackula, you see the shades of homophobia. I mean, almost any movies from the 70s or 80s or even the 90s, you find problematic aspects. And the blaxploitation era is no different. But what's significant about it is this idea of representation. And it was a period where the economic model in Hollywood was such that you could produce movies meant specifically for Black audiences that would play in Black theaters, and that was enough. Since then, you hear so often, well, it won't play in foreign markets. It won't. So there was a period after that where you would long for the Blaxploitation era because it was harder to justify, you know, making a film for a Black audience. But during the 70s, you could do that. So during that period, you come out not just with a film like Shaft, which, of course, most people have seen, but these horror films, Blackula and Abby, that show Black characters in their lives. And sometimes there's a little opposition to racism. You know, you're going to beat up a few white cops or whatever. But it was about Black folks and their story and their vampire.
And you just brought up Blackula. And one of the points you made is Blackula was deadlier than Dracula. Why do you think it was okay to be deadlier, bloodier, more gory with Black bodies for Black audiences? What do you think is going on there?
Well, you said a mouthful there.
yeah, you know. Blackula deadlier than Dracula. Right. That's
oh, yeah, there's blood flowing everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, that's true. I mean, some of it could have been just sort of boundary pushing as the years progressed, because these were a bit later, you know, than some of those earlier Universal, you know, Black and white depictions. But you raise a good point.
Well,
Sorry, go on.
You raise the point of horror as redemptive, and I wonder if it's connected.
Well, okay, there is that. I mean, now Blackula does have both Black and white victims, so it's not a straight line of retribution horror, you know, in that particular film. But yeah, I mean, sure, seeing Blackula throw a police officer across the room, you know, that kind of thing. If you're a Black person of that era and you had some trouble with profiling or brutality or harassment, then that would feel healing to you. You know, you it's something that you can see visually on the screen that helps ease some of that tension. So there are probably a lot of factors at play in terms of why he's deadlier, why he's bloodier. He's also sexier, you know, so we can have a conversation about that. But perhaps it also was just sort of a new interpretation of the genre, you know, emerging, you know, in William Crane's version of a vampire as opposed to those earlier manifestations.
You mentioned the incredible success of Jordan Peele and Get Out, which is a groundbreaking movie on all sorts of levels. They spared no expense and bought an ad right before the Super Bowl on Sunday introducing his newest movie, which is called Us. He gave an interview to Rolling Stone, and he said, "I realized I'd never seen a horror movie of this kind where there's an African-American family at the center that just is. This is a young African-American family who are on an idyllic vacation, and it turns into a nightmare because they're stalked by a family of monsters." So in a way, it's race-neutral casting. It could have been any kind of family. This happens to be a Black family who are in this movie and having the same kinds of challenges that people have been having in horror movies for a long time. Are we getting to a place where the acceptance, the presence of Black bodies in movies is going to become, regardless of the genre, is just going to become less and less notable?
Well, you know, time will tell. There have been great strides, and Jordan Peele has really opened things up for so many creators in Hollywood, especially genre creators. But one of the things I tell my students in my class is that Black horror doesn't have to mean that it's confronting a social issue or that there's retribution based on race or oppositional in terms of race, because it is still so revolutionary for the story to be about us that the fact that, like, say a movie like Us, the fact that it's a Black family, even if there is no other racial conversation, is still revolutionary. And I think it will be for some time to come. It'll take a few successes, you know, because one of the things we've learned in film with Black film is that a success does not mean you're going to succeed upward. Sometimes those successful directors were succeeding downward. It's like, oh, great, Boomerang was a hit, so I guess we're going to see a whole lot more movies like Boomerang or a whole lot more movies like Devil in a Blue Dress. No, we didn't. So time will tell. I am cautiously optimistic. I think because it's so much easier to make films, that you can literally shoot a film on your iPhone, that is going to help people get past barriers. There are so many ways to showcase a film that can work around the studio system if you're intrepid and if you can raise the money through crowdfunding and other ways that didn't exist, you know, just a few years ago. So for that reason, I think Black creators are going to be pushing harder for change. But change is slow and change is difficult. And even, you know, there's probably a meeting right now where some executive is saying, does this character have to be Black?
And the right to be ordinary actually is revolutionary for
it is. Yeah.
And
absolutely.
And you talk about the ordinary fears of people of color that go way back in these movies. There's a movie that you point to called The People Under the Stairs, which somebody calls the Get Out of the Reagan era. So this is 1980s, and it talks about the Black fear of white spaces. And, of course, Get Out is another movie that picks up that theme. So, I mean, this is something that, you know, the ordinariness, and as Sherry alluded to in the very beginning of our conversation, you know, the daily trauma, the daily challenges, these are coming out in these movies.
And one thing that is clear is that those daily challenges and that daily trauma will not be going anywhere anytime soon. So if nothing else, there will
sure.
be plenty of fodder.
Yeah.
For these new stories, whether it's just the representation is like, oh, it's a Black family. Can we live? Yeah. Can we just be? You know, there's that too. Something that's more direct and in your face. And horror is such a unique way to showcase social problems that there will be plenty of material for filmmakers in the years to come.
Tananarive Due is an educator and an award-winning author of 12 novels. She is one of the executive producers of this terrific movie. I very much encourage you to check it out. It's a documentary called Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. It premieres Thursday on Shudder TV, which I'll confess I've never heard of before, but you can subscribe to Shudder TV through Amazon and Netflix. And we've got a link to the trailer of the documentary on our website, WIPR.org/midday. Tananarive Due, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. This has been fun.
Dr. Sherry Parks is here with me in Studio A. Coming up next on Midday Culture Connections, we move out of the shadows and into the light with a look at representations of God on television. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Now, with the polls showing that America is becoming less religious, interestingly, God remains very popular on television. From shows like Highway to Heaven in the 1980s to God Friend in Me, that's a current hit in the CBS lineup, God often means ratings gold. If you'd like to tell us about your favorite shows or least favorite shows about God, our phone number here at Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. We're streaming on Facebook, and you can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. So it is kind of interesting. The Pew Research and Religion shows that, you know, people, particularly millennials, younger people, less attracted to organized religion, less, there's less attendance at churches and synagogues and even mosques. There's just less connection to religion. But God is still a hit.
Well, we have to pull out just a little bit. Americans are still the most religious people in the post-industrial world. But what is happening, and that permeates a lot, what is happening is that the people who are willing to say that they are religious is dropping. The people who say they're spiritual is rising. And we can talk about what the difference is, but even when you look at religiosity, the American way of religion is a lot like shopping. And that, I mean, instead of kind of, you know, being brought into one religion and that's what you are for the rest of your life and that's what you teach your children, Americans are picking and choosing. You know, we've thought about Presbyterians and Catholic Boos who are picking a little bit from Buddhism. And I mean, this has been pretty well documented that Americans are pretty much like, oh, that looks good. Let me take that. No, that looks good. And so if you think about that and where that energy goes, in many ways, it goes into the popular culture. So, you know, certainly there are people who go to church by watching TV, but I'm not talking, we're not talking about that. We're talking about mostly situation comedies where God is not the fire and brimstone Christian, because they often are Christian-based, but God is benign or friendly or irascible, and somebody, you know, like the president used to be someone revered, and now they're just people, and now God is kind of just people.
Interestingly, way back in the 1950s, there was a program called Life is Worth Living. It was on ABC, and it was a vehicle for a Catholic Archbishop, Fulton Sheen, to preach directly into the camera. And for a while, it was even popular enough to outrate Milton Berle and other, you know, huge things. So there's a longstanding tradition of religion being just generally popular. But it is interesting. I mean, are people going to church on watching TV instead of actually physically going to church?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was this whole period after that. Now, I grew up in the South, so, you know, before he was respectable, Oral Roberts would ask you to put your foot on the TV set. And there were a lot of people, and I don't mean I shouldn't disparage it, there are people who felt that they were cured. And that, you know, there were also the Catholic nuns in wing chairs. So there were people who were using that, because organized religion is, I mean, you have to get up. You have to go. And we know all kinds of data that when people have to get up out of their chairs and go somewhere, that tends to drop after a while. But it's interesting that you quoted Life Worth Living, because these new shows are less about religion and more about ethics and more about good people doing good things. And even one show is The Good Place. So it's good people, good places, good work.
Yeah, a metaphor for heaven. There's that show with Fred Armisen and Maya Rudolph called Forever on Netflix, which is what it's like to be in heaven. So is part of this a continuing exploration by humankind of the afterlife and the basic questions of human existence? You know, what's it all about, Alfie?
I think certainly there is that, but also when people are suffering, and it's interesting how this ties into what we were just talking about. Now the general population is feeling that chronic day-to-day stress and tension. And so to imagine not the horror in this case, but the good place, the afterlife is, I mean, generations of people who have been disenfranchised and suffering, imagine a good place. That's different. But also we're in this large conversation as a country about ethics. And so people are often asking, well, where are the good people? Well, there's some on TV. Yeah.
The star of God Friended Me, it seems to me an interesting premise. Have you seen the show?
I have not seen the show. I have to admit that I watch it.
Yeah. Good for you. Brandon Michael Hall, I think I'm pronouncing his name right, Michael. He's a millennial. He's in New York, and he's an atheist, and he has a podcast. And his father is an old-fashioned preacher. I mean, an organized religion.
Episcopalian.
There you go. And it's interesting that to me, the metaphor of friending somebody on Facebook or on a social media stand-in is a kind of really interesting way to have a relationship with God, who you don't actually, you know, sit across and look at, you know, at a table.
Our relationships with God have been mediated for a long time. When nobody was literate, but the priest, and the priest was reading to you, that's mediated. So, I mean, if you include paper, there's this long period. And this is really interesting because we're also kind of wary but involved in tech in our lives. And the idea that God could be somewhere in there is a really interesting mixture of the mysterious.
And in the Christian tradition, particularly, I think less so in the Judaic tradition, and I don't know at all about the Islamic tradition when it comes to the individual relationship to God. There's a guy who's the head of the religion department at Boston University 20 years ago, wrote a book called The American Jesus, and about how relationships with Jesus change from this, as you say, this sort of, you know, literally celestial being to my best friend. You know, you got stoned with Jesus and hate Ashbury, you know, you hung out with Jesus, and Jesus is just all right with me, as the Doobie Brothers used to sing. It evolved from a dispassionate relationship to a very intimate relationship.
And praying for football games. I mean, the idea that Americans, there's this really interesting study that Americans will ask God to help them find a parking space. And then the belief in angels has become much more pervasive, that there is, and I'm not disputing any of this, but the idea that there are other beings who care deeply about you and will look out for you. It goes very much to the ancient kitchen gods, that you had your own personal entity that was looking out for you. And you can begin to understand how that feeds into how we are as a culture.
And one of the most interesting, you bring up angels, one of the most successful of these God-based television shows is the one called Touched by an Angel, which was on for almost 10 years.
Oh, it's still on. Yeah. I mean, it's syndication. There are lots of people who are still watching it. A black woman.
Yeah, Joan of Arcadia, yeah. Which was a big hit, but it was only there for a couple of years. I mean, even people look back to The Flying Nun, mm-hmm. Sally Field. And I mean, there is a deep tradition of this. And I wonder how much it has shaped our view of theology, shaped our notion of a relationship with the divine, watching these characters on television.
Well, and anytime you're talking about the media, you're talking about something that goes into almost a funhouse mirror, because, I mean, you can argue what organized religion is or is not, but television is definitely trying to turn a profit. So they're not going to make you but so uncomfortable, not in a comedy. So this is definitely religion light. It's not asking a whole lot of you. God, being offended by God, I mean, God is asking people to do something, but they always win. You know, they always fulfill their mission, and everybody feels good at the end. I think it's really interesting to watch how, if you think of religion as mythology, and I don't mean fake story here, I mean legend structure, it makes sense that it would weave itself or get woven by people in the culture into their stories, which is happening.
And I suppose, if when we talk about the mythology of the so-called American dream, and the spiritual dimension to the notion of being American, what it means to be American, and how those different notions are thought of in communities of color, in older communities, in younger communities. I mean, the way we can parse ourselves,
Now, communities of color are much more religious. I mean, mm-hmm. than main, what we would consider mainstream. I put that in quotes, whites, much more.
And so, you think the relationships of communities of colors to these kinds of television programs is markedly different as well?
Well, I think it reaffirms what they already believe. I mean, there's some studies, some of them out of Hopkins, about prayer and healing. And when you look at who they studied, they studied people of color, because that's the benign, caring God who's always with you.
Is there are there new frontiers to be found and had in this the lineage of these shows, from Highway to Heaven through God Friended Me? What's the next step? If God's now on Facebook, where do we find God next?
Maybe under the stairs. Yeah. But no. Well, I think the blending of spirituality and self-help, self-improvement is interesting, and we're starting to see that.
Yeah, Marie Kondo, I guess. All right, Sherry, yeah. Always good to see you. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Dr. Sherry Park, she's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at MICA, the author of Fierce Angels, Living with the Legacy from Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman, and she joins us every month for Midday Culture Connections. She also hosts Beyond the Ballot here on WYPR every other Thursday during All Things Considered. That's it for us today. We hope you'll join us tomorrow for a reaction to President Trump's State of the Union speech, as well as the Democratic response, which will be delivered by Stacey Abrams, the former Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia. Political scientist Norman Ornstein will join me with his thoughts on the speeches, and you can hear those speeches this evening here on WYPR starting at 9 o'clock. Plus, tomorrow here on Midday, Baltimore journalist Sean Yost and Baltimore Ceasefire co-founder Erica Bridgeford join me for reflections on the first ceasefire weekend of 2019. And we'll have a preview of the Motor Trend International Car Show with Rory Cahill in advance of his getting his license and the show coming to Baltimore this weekend. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. They also provide catering and a party room for all your special events. You can find out more at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. If you're celebrating Chinese Lunar New Year today, Happy New Year. Have a great day.